and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris. Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Every December 10th, the world marks Human Rights Day. And this year is the 75th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is one of the first documents drafted by the United Nations that decreed in writing that all people are born free and equal. However, in light of the ongoing atrocities in Gaza and other conflicts around the world, how can nations and international bodies reconcile the paradox of celebrating human rights milestones while bearing witness to continued violations that contradict the very principles outlined in the declaration? Joining me on the show today is Katrina Jorin Maliamal. She's the executive director of Amnesty International Malaysia. Katrina, thank you for being on the show with me. Welcome. And I'm glad you're taking time to speak to us today on Human Rights Day, ahead of Human Rights Day. And I do want to ask you about the significance of this year's Human Rights Day, which is also the 75th anniversary of the UDHR. Do you think there is a dissonance between the values espoused by the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the global response to the ongoing human rights violations in Gaza?
Yeah, thank you so much, Melissa, for having me to begin with. And just always glad for the opportunity to talk about human rights and share sort of these thoughts with a wider audience. So I think that, I mean, just maybe taking a step back, so you've noted that this is the 75th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, or the UDHR. I think the context of how the UDHR came to be is also really important, right? And so it sort of came from the ashes of World War II. And when we saw sort of like the worst of humanity, and we are grappling in that time, we were grappling as to what do we do with sort of the situation, the context that we're in, where these horrible atrocities have happened, you know, devastating consequences. And then you have this process and this commitment of people coming into discussion and a vision for what is the world that we want that isn't the atrocities that we've just seen, right? And so that process led us to this global framework for justice and for really critically this recognition of equal and inalienable rights for all people. And so the moment right now, I think when we talk about marking the 75th anniversary, I think the word celebration can evoke perhaps joyousness and maybe a lightness. I think joy is really important in any struggle, but it's certainly not one about lightness, right? And so in fact, this moment calls us to be really clear-eyed about what the vision of the UDHR is. I think it is proof that we can have a global vision for rights, that it is possible, and that it must be realized, right? And so this isn't a moment for us to retreat or to diminish what it means to make that call that we all have rights. I think I personally get very moved when I think about the tenets of the principles of human rights. When we talk about the UDHR, we talk about rights being universal. So regardless of our borders, rights being inherent, we have rights because of who we are, and that our rights are interrelated and they are connected to each other. And so whether we are talking about a child who's under the rubble in Gaza, or a farmer fighting for their rights in Kedah, or a writer speaking difficult truths in KL, or a man on death row in Sky Bulo, or a woman, you know, fighting for bodily autonomy in the US, I think this point about the UDHR reminding us that our rights belong to us, that they ought to be cherished, and really important, defended repeatedly. There is a call to action by states also in to protect the rights of all persons within their borders, and that this must be done without hesitation and without compromise. And so I think that it is a stark contrast where people are seeing globally this erosion of rights, the denial of rights, but we're also seeing a loud exclamation and movement of people claiming their rights and defending it, and defending it for people that they've never met in contexts that they've never been, because they see that recognition of that common shared humanity, which is what the UDHR calls us to do.
Right. So I want to go back to the principles of the UDHR. I think the idea of equal, free and equal may be challenged today, given what is seen to be apparent double standards in the approach to human rights violations. And we see that in the conflict, the genocide in Gaza. How do we think about international governing bodies, universal, United Nations, for instance, or global bodies, thinking about decision-making processes that may be of a different time, that as you talked about the claiming of rights now, we need to maybe reconfigure or rethink and deconstruct our existing power structures of global governance institutions, maybe to better reflect more inclusive rights, more decolonial feminist approach to human rights.
Yeah, so I think that the that this struggle, so for starters, we often use the word struggle when we speak about rights, because it is a struggle, right? These need to be fought for, they need to be, that it is contention, that is it's difficult, and often you're coming up against power structures that have their own motivations, that also are doing things to maintain power. So all of that has always been true. And even when we look at the drafting of the UDHR, although it was, they call it undoubtedly a victor's project, its drafting wasn't controlled by those in power alone. And so, I'm not an expert in this, but I know a little about it that I can share. So for example, smaller nations, for example, or groups from the global south, were the ones that inserted the language around the universality of rights. So it was the Egyptian delegation actually that pushed for the universality of human rights and their applicability to persons subjected under colonial rule also. It was women delegates from India and Brazil and the Dominican Republic that pushed for equal rights of men and women to be affirmed. It was really the global south states that were pushing for economic and social rights to be inserted and privileged, not just civil and political rights. And so I think when we speak about the UDHR, again, understanding that history, I know in Malaysia sometimes it's talked about as if it's sort of this Western concept, but when you look at how it came into being, it really was this struggle from all across the world, and people from our region and our communities, and women who often get left out also of the narrative, who are stating no, as whether or not some in the groups under colonial rule, we have rights, because, and that's what the inherentness of our human rights means, that it cannot be about just where the borders are, it has to be universal. And so I think that the need for us then to again not surrender to the critiques of how it is being utilized or how rights in the systems are unjust, and say that is the way it is. In fact, it's forcing us to say, what is the counter movement that we are going to build that is one that is intergenerational, that is diverse, that has people of various abilities and disabilities, of right. Whether or not you're a stateless person or a migrant or a Malaysian or a citizen, and the class dynamics. I think that's the kind of counter voice that we need. And I think we're seeing the roots of this come up in the kind of
If I can kind of interject here and ask you, I mean, the idea of sometimes we often think of, only international bodies or global governance institutions or governments and nations are the only people, the only custodians of human rights. But when you talk about a counter movement, this counter, this pushback against some of the older, maybe irrelevant systems today or obsolete systems today, what role do you envision civil society playing, grassroots movements playing, even the public playing, in advocating for universal, the principles of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights?
I think it is a vital, necessary role that the world that we want to bring into existence is not going to be born without us forming relationships, practicing sort of that imagination of what we want, doing that learning to understand that these are the issues, building our critical analysis. I mean, we must never allow our rights to be held and controlled by groups of people in power. I mean, this is a lesson whether we're speaking about international human rights law or we're speaking about ourselves as citizens in this country. The call to us is to always participate in the process of world making. And that means, you know, fighting to have a civic space. And so, you know, from Amnesty's side and for many others here, that's why we fight very hard around freedom of expression, the right to protest, the right to access information, because and we see globally the right to protest is under attack. You know, freedom of expression is under attack because those in power understand that if people had a clear vision as to what is going on, if they were able to connect and foster relationships across the barriers that are enforced, then that poses a very a powerful counterforce that they don't want to reckon with. And so I don't think it's an option. I think if we are seeing how the institutions are failing us, then it's incumbent on us to organize and to either force those institutions to change or to come up with a conception of what is it that we actually do want that's going to work for us.
All right. Can I ask you, Katrina, I mean, in light of the atrocities in Gaza, there's such attention, there's a global spotlight on what's happening. Mm-hmm. How has that affected or influenced discourse on human rights here in Malaysia? What have been your observations?
I think that the conversations in Malaysia around Palestine and Gaza, there's a long history of Malaysia supporting Palestinians, and that's great and that's fine. But I also think that it has not been one where we are truly thinking about what it means to defend rights for all people. So if we are understanding what Palestinian resistance or what people are saying who are trying to get out of occupied territories, if you're understanding what it means to be under occupation, can we take that analysis and apply it to indigenous groups? Can we look at the violence that is imposed on entire communities and say, are we practicing or are we enabling other forms of violence, state violence to happen, even if it's not at the same scale, but do we enable that and excuse it when it happens within our backyard? I think we've certainly not made that connection between refugees and individuals who are fleeing violence and persecution, because the one hand you have people in Malaysia who are supporting Palestine, and at the exact same time you have people who are fleeing conflicts, and even Palestinians whose rights as refugees are not protected in this country. We have the state apparatus of censorship. So we see in Israel dissidents who are questioned, you know, investigated, the control of social media. And then on Malaysia side, perhaps again not at the same scale, but we see that our social media, we see freedom of expression being restricted, you know, the repressive laws are still being used. We talk about gender justice and reproductive rights, and we see what's happening to people in Palestine and women there. Are we able to do that same analysis for our context? So I think that this urgent moment does require urgent responses, but we cannot just be focused on it as if it's a somewhere there issue, because again, the call for human rights is to make the connections and to understand that if we are enabling and allowing human rights violations to happen for any community, then that degrades rights for all of us. And the responsibility is on Malaysians and people in Malaysia too.
So having said that, what developments that have happened this year do you think most exemplify the human rights issues that we are dealing with in the country? What do these incidents reflect about the state of human rights here in Malaysia?
So I think, I mean, that there are a lot, and I don't want to say that I'm giving a full comprehensive picture. It's not fair to all the different struggles and people fighting for it. But a couple of things stand out. And I mentioned the need for us to really be very vigilant and to defend our civic space. And here, I mean, we're looking at the fact that the government has failed to fulfill its commitments to reform laws restricting the rights to freedom of expression. And so we see the continued use of repressive laws to silence critical voices, to prevent peaceful protest. I'm thinking in, you know, several examples, and this again is not an exhaustive list. The questioning of the participants and organizers of the Women's March to mark International Women's Day. I mean, to in on this, it was a group of people who took to the street to who were stating and demanding equal rights and women's justice and women's rights, and to have them then be hauled up by the police for questioning. I think some of the either organizers or protesters had the police show up at night to give them a letter. I think for me that marks a very, it was in the first quarter of this year, so around March, that marked a very chilling moment, because even though it wasn't in the sense of how we see a crackdown of protests where, you know, there's batons and tear gas and water cannons, this form of intimidation is still very frightening, and again signals a squashing of the civic space. We look at the harassment and the death threats faced by the director and producer of Mantega Terbang, a film about a woman exploring the concept of the afterlife and about religion. And so not only were they harassed and received literal death threats and, you know, I think acid and red paint splashed in their personal property, but the inaction of the state to crack down and to ensure safety, and the action of the state then to have the police question them. I mean, we look at the use of the Printing Presses and Publications Act and the increasing sort of restrictions, not just to freedom of expression, but the intersections with LGBTI rights. And so that climate of silencing is, I think, a real mark of what this year has also felt like. I want to just point out two things, two other things also. I think looking at the continued treatment and ill treatment of migrants and refugees and the infrastructure of immigration detention, I think there was something like 14,000 people who were detained. This was a statistic from May, I believe, including over 1,000 children. And we talk about again, so folks are looking at Palestinians held in Israeli prisons and saying that's unjust. We're talking about the children held there. Why are we okay with individuals being held in immigration detention because of administrative reasons? And this is essentially for refugees in particular, it's indefinite detention. There was a case of enforced disappearance, a suspected enforced disappearance of a Myanmar refugee and activist, Thuzam Mong, and her children, who were abducted by unknown people from a home in Selangor. And we understand a police investigation was open, but they, you know, no further updates. The police deaths in police custody have continued. So I think as of between January to October, I think 10 people reported, and yet the public fervor and the attention and custodial debts has waned, but people are still dying, right? And there doesn't seem to be an independent and effective system and investigation, let alone justice for victims. And so these patterns of how I'm seeing state violence manifest themselves, whether it's against people in police custody, whether against refugees, is incredibly worrying, not just for the violence itself, but that there isn't a robust response to prevent it and to investigate and to bring justice.
So, right.
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, Katrina, I'm just wondering whether, you know, the list, as you were saying, brings back a lot of the headlines and the news reporting when it happened, but I think people tend to always dismiss and move on to other more pressing news headlines and such. Are there areas that within human rights that remain overlooked or receive insufficient attention from the Malaysian media, from public discourse? And I know that Amnesty International is planning a festival to shine a light on some of these pressing issues. How do you see the event helping to maybe bring back some of these forgotten narratives into public discourse?
So I think that if we just think about it as news items, then of course it's going to, you know, move through the news cycle and then we move on. What we need to really be thinking about is, and I only named some things, right? I mean, there's all of these discussions from in indigenous rights activists fighting for their land, the climate justice, food security, and what farmers are telling us. I mean, there's a lot. And where we need to start practicing our thinking is on connecting the dots between these issues. So how is a right to education issue, a statelessness issue, how is an indigenous land rights issue, a food security issue, what is it? And I think these are the intersections that are really required of us. And so in the framing, in the media, in the sort of the landscape, it's not just what are the issues that are overlooked, but the lack of an intersectional perspective, a lack of a class dimension. So when we talk about police violence, for example, or the death penalty, there's a very much a class element to it. I also think that in a lot of this framing, the treatment of non-citizens is talked about as if it just pertains to migrants, refugees, or stateless people. And that is important, but if we can start to understand how the treatment of non-citizens and the degradation of their rights affects all our rights in Malaysia. I'll give you an example, right? How can we as Malaysians say there isn't enough money for a robust healthcare system when we are spending millions of ringgit detaining children? I think, you know, these are sort of the questions that Malaysians need to start asking. And so the festival that Amnesty International is running are starting from the 8th of December and until the 10th of December at the KL Selangor Chinese Assembly Hall. It's called We Make Our World, with a subheading, Our Rights Are Interrelated and Our Lives Are Intertwined. And so what we're trying to do here is to create a space where we've pulled together various human rights issues from Malaysia and globally. And we're asking those in the audience and those coming to think about what are these connections between the realities that we're seeing. And so we have, for example, three wonderful Malaysian artists who are in their art grappling with the question of police violence. There is a very moving photo exhibition of family members of people in death row in Singapore. We have a discussion on citizen journalism and a workshop on it in order to how do we practice getting our right to information. There's a session with primary school age children on understanding their rights. And so I think what we're trying to do here is to get people to come together in a literal space, because what we also need for a movement is relationships with each other, to think and talk and feel, and also to practice that imagination about what is the world that we want. We're also bringing an international perspective to the program. So Amnesty runs the Right for Rights campaign every year, which is the biggest human rights event. Literally millions of people around the world engage in solidarity actions for people whose rights are violated in different parts of the world. And so this year we'll be focusing on Brazil, South Africa, Myanmar, and the US. And on Friday evening, we'll be having a solidarity evening with Gaza. And so we're through all of these international actions, we're also asking Malaysians to think about what it means to be a global citizen and to really understand that the struggle for human rights and justice must always be a global one. And so go ahead.
Sounds exciting, like lots planned. And I'm glad that it's happening in a physical space where we can kind of foster that connection and relate to each other. But I'm wondering whether sometimes the dialogue around human rights is often concentrated or centered in urban liberal progressive circles. And I'm wondering how we can broaden that dialogue about human rights to include other communities and other demographics.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that if we say that our movements have to be intersectional, they have to be diverse, then that represents a geographical diversity, it's a class, language, all of that diversity, right? I think it's really important that we act from where we are at, meaning not to just surrender to, okay, this is all I have, but it's a call to everybody to map out what are your networks, what are your resources, what are you able to do with the resources and networks that you have, right? And so this means that we, if you're listening to this and you're in, you know, in Alostar and you're thinking, what do I want to do? Then reach out, you know, look into who in your community you want to host a discussion with. I mean, have a film screening. It doesn't have to be many big things, but I think we do need to plant seeds for action, for thinking in all the different spaces that we're in. I also think that, you know, we have to grapple with the reality we're in. When I talk about shrinking civic space, it is hard to do human rights work in Malaysia. There are restrictions. There are restrictions for us to mobilize openly, to hold large gatherings. I think there are security considerations that we take into account all the time, which can make it difficult for people to also want to take a risk to organize a human rights event. The censorship that we face also means that it's difficult for people to get access to information. I wish we could easily go on public radio and on our public TV channels to talk about human rights issues, but it's very hard. And so I think folks are trying to do what they can with the resources that they have. The resources in Malaysia are also often not available for human rights work. I think they may be available for charity work. And so if these are the realities, they don't mean that we shouldn't move out of the circles that we're in, but I think the call is on all of us to figure out how we expand those circles and build relationships.
Katrina, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. Katrina Jorin Mariamal from Amnesty International Malaysia, wrapping up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching and good night.